and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. Today, two stories that reflect Australia's ambivalent historical relationship with the Orient. First, the visit in 1939 from Hollywood's first Chinese-American movie star, Anna May Wong. Anna May Wong has become a cult figure among fans of Hollywood's golden age, the very embodiment of elegance and oriental mystique. It's hard to imagine such a glamorous figure here in the 1930s, yet Miss Wong did spend 3 months in Australia on the eve of the Second World War, doing a show on the Tivoli circuit. Oriental Stardust, Anna May Wong in White Australia, is produced by Catherine Franey, with Claudia Chan Shaw in the role of Anna May Wong.
I want to see those big countries down under, because I've met so many people who rave about Australia and New Zealand.
Anna May Wong will leave for a personal appearance tour in Australia after she finishes work on her current picture, North of Singapore.
She will arrive late in May and commence her tour of the Tivoli circuit in June.
Anna May Wong was, as she described herself, the only Chinese film star in the world.
Of course, she was a really good actor. She was beautiful. She carried the glamour, the artifice, the style, the wonderment of the Hollywood studio system in her very being. And I think she brought that to Australia when she came here in 1939.
She was amazingly beautiful. She had absolutely drop-dead good looks. And besides that, she had a Steve McQueen coolness about her. As a screen presence, I think she left a lasting image on the viewer of any film that she was in. Well, my name's Derham Groves. I teach architecture at the University of Melbourne, but my interest is in popular culture and architecture, or popular culture and place. I've spent far too long looking at Sherlock Holmes. One of the films that I did watch was a 1933 English film of the Sherlock Holmes story, A Study in Scarlet. And in this film, Anna May Wong appears.
Good morning, Mr. Holmes.
Mrs. Pike, when did you last see your husband alive?
We dined together last night at the Savoy Grill. He left me shortly after 9 o'clock. I never saw him again.
From that point on, she was always on my radar.
An hour ago, I received a message to come here, where I identified the body of my poor husband.
Permit me to express my sympathy for your great loss.
Thank you. Is that all?
Anna May Wong was a Chinese-American actress. She was born in America, raised in Los Angeles. Her career more or less spanned between the wars, and because of that, she was seen as a bit of an Art Deco diva. Certainly, she was very fashionable, and her films reflect an Art Deco style. The trouble with her on-screen career, of course, was that it was restricted because she was Chinese. In those days, she wasn't allowed to actually kiss Caucasian men on screen. And what that effectively did, of course, was kill her career as a romantic lead. I mean, she did have a career, but it was restricted largely to playing the villain.
What do you think? I think that the lady is a liar.
Ling Moy, I can't believe such loathsome jealousy in you.
No jealousy. Just merciless vengeance.
I can't for the life of me understand why a white man couldn't fall in love with me on the screen without breaking some terrible censorship law. What is the difference between a white girl playing an Oriental and a real Oriental like myself playing them? The only difference I can see is that in most cases, I would at least look the part, where the white girls definitely do not.
It wasn't until I read Russell Gower Hodges' biography of Anna May Wong that I realised that she'd actually visited Australia. and his biography and other biographies hardly mentioned her trip to Australia in 1939.
Music and drama, Anna May Wong. The Sydney Morning Herald, the 11th of March, 1939. The engagement of Anna May Wong by Mr. Frank Neal was the only interesting theatre news of a quiet week. We may only speculate as to the form Miss Wong's act on the vaudeville stage will take. The memory of filmgoers recalls only vivid and occasionally sinister Oriental portrayals. One cannot remember having seen her in any sort of light role. Does Mr. Neal plan some miniature drama as part of the review in which he places her? We must wait in patience until Miss Wong appears.
Well, my name is Shirley Jennifer Lim. I'm an associate professor of history at the State University of New York. I've been interested in Anna May Wong for many years. She was part of my research for my first book, A Feeling of Belonging, Asian American Women's Public Culture. I was absolutely delighted to find out that Anna May Wong went to Australia in 1939. So I applied for a fellowship at ANU, and I was able to do a lot of original research on Anna May Wong's career in Australia.
She came in June and went in August. She was here about 107 days. This is one of the things that I like about this kind of research, really, where you can look at a person's time in Australia. They arrive on this particular date and they leave on this particular date, and in between you can forensically look at the events that took place and what they did, and there's something of the miniature world within that which I quite like.
Anna May Wong arrives on the RMS Aorangi tomorrow, Sunday morning at 8. Be there to welcome this illustrious daughter of China.
It was huge. She got press coverage across Australia, not just Sydney and Melbourne, but in Darwin, Brisbane, all over. And, you know, a lot of this has to do with Australians being one of the largest movie-going publics in the world. So Anna May Wong's movies had been circulating in Australia for about a decade and a half before she came to perform at the Tivoli in her vaudeville shows. There's newsreel of her arrival.
Thank you very much.
Yes, well, you see Anna May Wong, you know, with her fur coat descending the stairs, waving at her public. She has a bouquet of flowers, and then she picks up another bouquet on her way down the stairs. And then the footage shifts, and she's with the ambassador from China to Australia. And it's just one of those moments where you're like, oh my goodness, because it's not the voice that you necessarily expect to come out of her.
If the rest of my stay in Australia will be as pleasant and happy as today has been, I know that I shall enjoy every moment of it.
She really has almost a regal presence. You know, when I showed this clip at a talk I gave, so I was like, oh my gosh, it's like the queen is speaking. But it was also, you know, her carriage, the furs, her bearing, her poise, that there was zero thought of any submissive butterfly.
You've extended me a most warm welcome. And to the many Chinese who are listening in, may I say, Lai Wei Pang Yu, Wo Meng Li Gui Gui Fan Hei Ping Wan, Duo Jie, Duo Jie.
For the Chinese-Australian audiences to have a major Hollywood and European star, you know, somebody who had been in, you know, at that point, over 50 films, come and relate to them was, in fact, quite a exciting and also heartening experience.
The visiting actress, Anna May Wong, is delighted that members of Australia's Chinese community have given her such a wholehearted welcome. She has had many letters from them, and yesterday, when the train arrived in Sydney, deputations from the New South Wales Chinese Women's Relief Fund and the Young Chinese League were there to meet her.
The reason that she came to Australia was, in a sense, to get away from Hollywood. And what she stated in public at the time was that she was at this sort of crossroads. She wanted to get away from Hollywood and really reflect on her career. You know, she wanted people to come and see her movies because she was a good actor, not because she was Chinese.
You see, I'm a unique personality in motion pictures. I'm the only Oriental star in the world, and for that very reason, I'm hampered. People insist upon looking at me as a freak, something akin to a five-legged dog or a two-headed calf. I want to be an actress, not a freak.
She visited China for the first time in her life in 1936 and did not get the greatest reception there.
Because she played the villain on the screen, she was seen by mainland Chinese as putting the Chinese race into disrepute.
But, you know, here she is going to Australia in 1939, and unlike China, she's being received by dignitaries, you know, the red carpet's being rolled out for her, and she's really having a wonderful time in Australia.
Miss Wong shows the Minister for External Affairs how to manage his chopsticks at a Chinese dinner at Prince's.
Miss Anna May Wong found this baby koala a quaint companion when she visited the sanctuary at Healesville yesterday.
Meet Anna May Wong. The exotic star will arrive by car in front of the Tivoli, midday, Monday next.
She was brought out to Australia by Frank Neal, who was the impresario, I guess, who was in charge of the two Tivoli theatres. And he'd been trying to get her to come to Australia since about 1934. Many of these shows, like the one that Anna May Wong appeared in, they kind of had a foreign big star. For example, in 1937, he brought Nina Mae McKinney, the black American singer, out.
There's rhapsodian dance, rhapsodian singing brings her sweet romance.
There are a number of acts, whether they're singers or dancers or boxers, who represented racial difference. And this wasn't just Australia. This was, in fact, common in the United States as well as in Europe, in vaudeville.
So she was in a show called Highlights from Hollywood. I mean, it was variety in every sense of the word. They had dancers and singers and acrobats.
Dance creations on the wire.
Betty Burgess and Sonny Lamont.
South America's foremost instrumentalists.
The radio racketeer, Bugs Wilson.
America's young comedy star, Jack Lane.
World-famous Chinese actress, Anna May Wong.
So there were some variations in what she actually performed in Australia. And of course, since this is vaudeville in 1939, there's only the newspaper accounts to go by. So in one of her performances in Sydney, she came in wearing an oriental coat and a headdress, you know, presumably a very sort of orientalist, quasi-Chinese looking headdress, and sang a Chinese folk song. But then her next song was when she sang I'm an Australian Girl and gave her impressions, actually, of being an Australian girl. And I would love to have been there to actually see her do this. She also performed a French song and a song based on Noel Coward's Half-Caste Woman, lamenting the fate of being caught between two different cultures.
The lyrics of that song, I think, are very telling because, you know, she could relate to these sorts of lyrics very well. And this sort of notion that you were not one or the other, I think, reflected her personal feelings of being not Chinese nor American.
Half-caste woman, living a life apart, where did your story begin? Half-caste woman, have you a secret heart? waiting for someone to win. Were you born of some queer magic in your shimmering gown? Is there something strange?
A timely dramatic episode entitled At the Barricade, based on an actual incident in the Eastern situation, will be introduced by Miss Anna May Wong in the Highlights from Hollywood production at the Tivoli Theatre today.
It seems that the show was not perhaps as well received as they thought it might have been, or certainly Frank Neal thought it might have been. So he really threw a tantrum, and this is described in Fred Parsons' book.
Fred Parsons, A Man Called Mo, 1973.
Fred Parsons, who was the kind of in-house writer for the Tivoli, describes this scene where Frank Neal calls everybody out on stage after a performance and just lets Anna May Wong have it, I mean, in really vicious style.
He called her a has-been, a no-hoper, and a faded old bag. With amazing dignity and control, she stood there until he'd finished. Then she said, very quietly, "Thank you, Mr. Neal," bowed low to him and walked off. And the entire company applauded her. The Tivoli's resident producer, Wallace Parnell, called me into his office. "We've got to do something to help Anna."
So Parsons wrote the little drama based around the military events that were happening in China at the time. The extraordinary thing about this, I think, was that it was all so fluid that they could respond to world events in this act.
The Sino-Japanese War was being fought at the time, and I wrote a 10-minute playlet in which Anna, as a Chinese woman captured by the Japs, sacrificed her own life to save the village in which she lived. Parnell okayed the script, and Anna liked it. They rehearsed all the following day, and the sketch, At the Barricades, went on for the second night of the season. It was what audiences expected from Anna, and it went well.
Thank you so very much.
What's really fascinating about the 1930s is that there's some real changes in Australia's relationship with Asia. Historically, Australian national identity has been formed through the exclusion of Asians and Chinese in particular, but this relationship is really changing in the 1930s, starting with the 1931 Sino-Japanese War. You know, across the world, people see the Japanese as being the bad Asians and the Chinese as being the heroic and resistant Asians.
In the late 1930s, everybody felt sorry for the Chinese because they were suffering. And there were lots of, sort of appeals to help the Chinese refugees. There was a lot of pro-Chinese feeling. It was very fashionable, I think, to be involved with China in this way, sort of modern, forward-looking and high-principled were the sorts of ideas that were flying around, and Anna May fitted into that beautifully.
The Young Chinese Relief Movement will hold the Anna May Wong Ball at the Wentworth Hotel. Miss Wong expressed the hope that all interested would cooperate to make the ball a great success, so that the funds to provide medical aid to the Chinese wounded and refugees would benefit considerably.
My name's Alison Bronowski. While I was working as a diplomat, I always had a book on the go, sort of on the side. And one of those was The Yellow Lady, in which I tried to account for how Australians had always, through the years, reacted to Asia and how they had expressed those reactions through the arts. I was unaware of Anna May Wong, and I'm delighted to know about her, because I assume that if I didn't know, then a lot of other people didn't either.
I'm sure you're very respectable, madam.
I must confess I don't quite know the standard of respectability that you demand in your boarding house.
I don't really think that there were any political agendas around Anna May Wong. She was a sort of here today, gone tomorrow phenomenon. But she did represent a consistent pattern, which was that people in Australia, because we were so isolated, people were anxious to be up with the latest that was going on elsewhere, and elsewhere was on the other side of the world very often. So whoever would come, whether it was a Japanese naval visit, an American naval visit the following year, or the first performance of Madame Butterfly, or of Turandot, or the arrival of Japanese theatre troops, anything like that, it would be a huge upwelling of popular enthusiasm, with queues stretching round the block to get tickets, and then a flow-on effect in the department stores of you buy the merchandise that goes with the thing, and there's a big craze, and everybody has, you know, tea sets that reflect the current thing. And that is the way a really isolated country behaves.
The Argus, 28th of June, 1939. The footpath was crowded outside a business house in Bourke Street. Women were breathless, and there was a decided mass movement toward the doorway. One little old woman, on her way to Swanson Street, was forced onto the roadway. "What is all the excitement?" she asked a friend, who was waiting with paper and pencil. "Why, don't you know? Anna May Wong, the film star, has just arrived."
I'm Sean Bradman, and I'm an associate professor at Deakin University in Media and Communication Studies, but my main area of interest is stardom and celebrity. Well, I think Anna May Wong's story suggests that stars are translatable, a global phenomenon, even then, or especially then, that even though she's a Chinese-American Hollywood film star, that she resonates in many spaces and places. She travelled to Europe, and she travelled here and was greeted and is lavished over in the same ways one might within the American national system itself.
Miss Wong, who has a quiet, serene manner and a low-pitched speaking voice, was an impressive figure in a slim black frock, ankle-length and slit to the knees, to display long white trousers of embroidered sheer.
There are absolute parallels between what goes on today. When she's written about, she's described in terms of what she's wearing, her clothes, the texture, the fabric, the colours, very much like the way that magazines will describe stars when they walk down the catwalk today. Red carpet event moments that she was consistently captured in. There was fans and admirers, you know, who would call out her name and demand her autograph. There was talks and invitations, and there was gossip around her while she was here. And she even gave beauty secrets. So if you look at that thread of events that she's involved in, very close to today. I suppose what's different is they're everywhere today. They're at the centre of contemporary culture, and I think that's the dramatic change. From small drops of stardom, we now have oceans, seas, galaxies. They seem to be everywhere. But of course, there is a paradox with that. The more they exist in culture, the more we see them, the more they dominate television news, reality television shows, I suppose the less special potentially they become.
Going backstage to meet the star. Table Talk, the 15th of June, 1939. After viewing An American Talkie at the Melbourne Picture House, it's not often you go backstage of the film and tell the leading actress that you thought she did a swell job. I'd been to the Capitol to see Anna May Wong play the main feminine role in King of Chinatown. So one can well imagine the unreality of leaving that theatre, wandering up to the Tivoli, and meeting the star of that film in the flesh.
With Anna May Wong, there was something else, and that's the idea around her identity as a Chinese-American struggling in the star system at that time because of her ethnic background. She struggled, actually, to get the roles that she really wanted. And so there's a tragic story within that narrative, too, around Orientalism, ethnicity and gender.
Well, Orientalism's been defined by Edward Said at great length. But basically, Orientalism is the pejorative imagination of a distant Middle East and Far East in the minds of the West, which is designed to put those people and their customs and societies down, to put them in a position of inferiority politically, economically, and aesthetically. That's Orientalism. Said talked about the negative, but the positive also exists. That is the idealization of the Orient. And there were people in Australia who were besotted with, for instance, Japanese art or Chinese theatre or various kinds of music or whatever it might be, and pursued them all their lives because they were so fascinated by the difference between that and the Western tradition in which they'd grown up. So these things can be cut different ways. Fetishization, of course, takes place in an atmosphere of scarcity. You know, if every other person in the street looked like Anna May Wong, she wouldn't have been anything like the celebrity she was. And if there had been, for instance, television, rather than just live theatre for people to go to, it wouldn't have been nearly so exciting to have her come either. So it's like, you know, if rubies were gravel, then nobody would want them.
Graceful, smartly dressed, and possessed of a superb sense of humour, Miss Wong is the Orient and the West in one person. One moment, she will be speaking of the mystery of China's lost cities. The next moment, the latest Hollywood wisecrack will cross her lips. But with it all, she has an arresting personality.
The most interesting and impressive meal I've ever eaten was at a restaurant in Shanghai. There were 43 courses. There were duck's tongues, shredded eels with sauce, and Peking duck. I have never tasted anything in the East or West so delicious as these.
Anna May speaks both German and French fluently. And above all, she has a keen sense of humor.
What do you think would happen if I sang something from Madame Butterfly in German? Fancy a Chinese singing a song in German from an opera written by an Italian around a Japanese story.
I mean, that's the kind of thing that could happen now. She could do M. Butterfly, you know, the Chinese version of the Chrysanthemum story, with somebody who's actually a Chinese female impersonator being the man, layer over layer of complication. That's the kind of thing that she would have been great for. And unfortunately, I think she probably did realize that she was ahead of her time.
I've just returned to Hollywood after a most marvelous year in China. My first visit to the ancestral country. All the Chinese ladies look so smart and vivid in the beautiful modern dress of China. And being feminine, it made a deep impression on me, not to mention my pocketbook. I could not resist to go completely Chinese in my wardrobe. This cape is a blending of the very old with the new. The material is tribute brocade from the Imperial Palace, made up along the latest Western line.
I'm sorry, but I only understand Cantonese.
Oh, I thought I could brush up on my Mandarin. The dress is from Beijing. The famous imperial yellow with the dragon, a symbol of old China.
I think what's really particular and interesting about Anna May Wong's embodiment of modernity is that she could do it in such a multivalent and hybridized way. In many ways, being American in the 1920s and 1930s was not a straightforward identity for her because, you know, like Australia, the United States had anti-miscegenation laws, anti-immigration laws, all sorts of rules and regulations regarding segregation ruled her life. So it was a hindrance, but in some ways it was also an inspiration for creativity to become this cosmopolitan woman of the world, speaking in her world English accent. One of the things I write about is in 1928, she was brought to Germany to star in pan-European films. And when she was in Berlin in 1928, she was interviewed by the noted German intellectual Walter Benjamin. And she was also toasted by Leni Riefenstahl and Marlene Dietrich. So she was able to take what would be a huge disadvantage, which was not getting the starring roles that she wanted in Hollywood, and taking, you know, the chance to go to Germany in the 1920s to become this sort of multivalent cosmopolitan person. And I believe it was that same impulse that brought her to Australia in 1939.
Eyes and ears in town. The Sydney Morning Herald, the 16th of August, 1939. Anna May Wong, the Chinese film star currently in Australia, received a cable this week offering her a part in a new film. Frank Neal agreed to release her from her contract 5 days early to enable her to reach Hollywood in time. I found Anna May Wong on B deck, so excited at sailing that she could hardly speak. She ran away 3 paces and then ran back again.
"Isn't it wonderful to be going home?"
she said.
She was not sorry to leave Australia. I think she was homesick. She actually left the show about a week early, and the excuse was that she had to go home to make an audition for a film. Now, certainly, if that's true, the film was not made. Of course, at that particular time, we are talking about the world on the verge of the Second World War. She actually arrived home on the day that the Second World War was declared. It was starting to get difficult to get berths on ships and things. She just made it in time.
With World War II, you see Anna May Wong's starring film roles really declining. There's a much more male aesthetic. So you see the rise, actually, of male film stars of Asian descent in Hollywood at this time, playing in these war films that focus on Asia and the Pacific. So it's a combination of a changing era, as well as her being an aging film star.
After the Second World War, you get a communist takeover in China. China is the new Cold War threat, and Japan is our newfound friend because the United States says so. Well, of course, anti-Chinese feeling goes all the way back in Australia. But as you go on through our history, you see this kind of thing rising and falling. So in the 1910s, 1920s, the Japanese were our allies. By the late 1930s, people had changed their view about Japan and replaced it with China, and Anna May fitted into that beautifully. The difference between somebody like Anna May visiting Australia and a Chinese gold digger 100 years earlier was that one was seen as cheap labour and a threat to Australian occupiers of the land, whereas Anna May was a diversion and an exotic, fascinating, almost titillating piece of foreign influence that Australians were only too happy to welcome.
"You've extended me a most warm welcome, and I thank you very much. And to the many Chinese who are listening in, may I say, La Wei Pang Yu, Wo Mong Li Gui Gui Fun Hei Ping Wan, Duo Jie, Duo Jie."
Oriental Stardust, Anna May Wong in White Australia, was produced by Catherine Franey, with technical production by Timothy Nicastri. The feature developed from an original idea by Derham, whose book, Anna May Wong's Lucky Shoes, is published by Culicidae Press. Shirley Jennifer Lim's work on Anna May Wong in Australia appears in the recent collection, Australia's Asia, From Yellow Peril to Asian Century. Just check our website for all the details, abc.net.au/radionational. You're listening to Hindsight here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam.